It's officially DC festival season, and we're super excited about this one coming up on May 18th. Africa on the Avenue is a celebration of the vibrant African immigrant community along Georgia Avenue Northwest. There's going to be interactive art installations, fashion shows, music, food, and local business stands. This one-day festival, organized by District Bridges' Lower Georgia Avenue Main Street program, truly has something for everyone. So I'll see you there on May 18th. Go to districtbridges.org to learn more.
Today on CityCast DC, we are talking about a couple of bills in the DC Council, one that is supposed to fight crime and another that deals yet again with the issue of restaurants and tips and service charges. Emily Davies of The Post and Anna Spiegeler of Axios have been following the stories. They're here to explain. Plus, the Artomatic show opens this weekend in the most 2024 of locations. Stick around to hear more. Today is Friday, March 8th. I'm Michael Schaefer, and here's what DC is talking about. Hey, Anna.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Hey, Emily.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Good to have you. So the issue that like all of DC, or at least all of my DC is talking about today is the latest skirmishes in Virginia about the funding that will either cement the move of the Capitals and Wizards across the river or scuttle it. We're going to be talking about that next week, and we hope everyone listens. But this week, the things that actually happened that weren't a bunch of legislators engaging in complex bank shop politics, one of them was a big passage of the Secure DC bill, which the top line is this is supposed to fight crime. It rolls back a number of police reforms and boosts some penalties. Emily, you cover this for The Post. You had a really great sort of recap of how the District of Columbia in 4 years moved from embracing police reforms to shunning them. Can you sort of give a sense of both of the bill and of sort of how we got here from there?
Yeah, that's a great question. And as always, it's quite complicated.
Dang it. I want it to be simple.
I know. Me too. I'll start by saying that this bill that passed, I would say, includes a number of adjustments and walkbacks to certain pieces of legislation that the council passed in 2021. But I wouldn't go so far as to say the pendulum has swung all the way back to where we were before George Floyd was murdered. I mean, the mayor has said it's a swing back toward the middle. I think some people would agree with her, others would disagree with her. But I think there at times might be a misconception that we've like gone all the way back to where we were like 20 years ago. That is not necessarily true, though there are some provisions in this bill that people point to and say, hey, we have not seen drug-free zones, for example, for quite a long time in DC. So at a high level, this bill came to be and passed nearly unanimously, in large part because of where we are with crime in DC. We had an epically bad year last year where we had more homicides than we'd seen since 1997. And the council fielded a lot of anger about that from residents who don't feel safe, some who've been victims of crime themselves, some of who've lost relatives to crime in DC, and they want to know what the council's doing. And they point to some of those measures that they passed in 2021 to say, hey, you passed these bills and now look where we are.
That's the public reaction, you know, and that's something you reported on there, hearing this when they go out to meet constituents and stuff. Do like actual crime experts, insofar as anybody understands why crime goes up or down, think that any of those 2021 measures boosted crime or led to this spike?
There's a lot of debate there among really smart people who study this issue, because making causal links is really complicated in a city as dynamic as DC is. A lot of experts who study this issue say, hey, more incarceration does not make people safer. There are a lot of studies that show the long-term effects of incarceration can actually be counterproductive. In the same vein, others say, hey, DC's gone a bit too far in the direction of lenience. So maybe there is some truth to putting in place some measures that address this feeling of impunity that some people may feel in DC, that they can commit crimes and get away with it. So I would say that there's just not a consensus yet, which is part of what's scary in some ways about passing a massive piece of legislation before we really have answers on what works and what doesn't work.
So Anna, you are a DC resident. You also have covered restaurants for a long, long time, meaning you cover sort of a prototypical small business that depends on foot traffic and also, you know, needs its own security. What do you personally make of this and what are you hearing?
Well, you know, I know crime has been a big issue in the dining community, especially in certain neighborhoods. You know, you hear a lot about crime on H Street impacting businesses, and there's been a wave of closures there. You know, I've definitely heard of restaurateurs saying they're seeing fewer people coming in from the suburbs because there is this worry of crime in the district. One of the interesting aspects is you see a lot more restaurants independent hiring expensive private security to be there as, you know, kind of a watch to make patrons feel safe.
So much of the reporting on this, so much of the public demand, that's some of the stuff that Emily, you've chronicled, involves a kind of like theater component, right? Which is you have the security guard outside. I don't know if that makes it any less likely that you get jumped on your way to the car after dinner, but it makes people feel good. And similarly, one of the claims about this bill was that there was a sort of, the public wanted to see some action. So they ordered up some action. But can we like dig into a couple of the things? Because, you know, I was struck by people in progressive circles, people in the media and so we've been discussing this as a very controversial bill and so forth. But if you look at the vote results, no votes against. Insofar as the general public, or at least their elected representatives go, it's not particularly divisive at all. But there were a couple of things in there that I think it kind of tells where there were efforts to make changes at the last minute. One involved, they want to boost or lower the threshold for what constitutes felony theft from something worth $1,000 to something worth $500. And there was an amendment to undo that, to make it so that it stays at $1,000. What happened there? And what were the arguments and what wound up happening?
Yeah, it's a good example, I think, of this debate that's unfolding inside of the council. And it's reflective in many ways of this tension that many residents here feel too in a city that's both traditionally extremely progressive and highly educated. So Councilmember Janice Lewis-George made a really passionate argument against decreasing the felony theft threshold from $1,000 to $500. She said that it would not prevent theft and would just give more people felony records, which sort of gets to the heart of this debate in many ways. How do we balance both wanting accountability and also wanting people to have a chance at a better life, even if they've committed a crime of some sort? And that's really complicated. So her amendment instead sought to make it a felony if somebody committed more than one theft in a 6-month period of items costing more than $1,000 total. Well, Councilmember Pinto argued against this. She led this omnibus bill and basically wanted to see that felony threshold lowered. She thinks that property crime is a big issue in DC. She's been hearing a lot, Anna, as you said, from business owners, from people who have a lot of power in DC. DC needs to keep its business owners relatively happy to have like thriving commerce and a happy public. But ultimately, Pinto lost that argument and that amendment put forward by Janice Lewis-George passed.
So the knock on that amendment was, listen, what they're doing is saying you get out of jail free card so long as you steal things less than $1,000. And if we want to have stores, pharmacies, retail in our neighborhoods, it's better to not scare them off by saying we're going to let people get away with ripping you off for less than $1,000. So Councilmember George, her argument back was no, the problem is that these lesser misdemeanor arrests are not being brought to court, not being prosecuted. What she wants to do is incentivize them to actually bring these cases. What do you do to do that?
Yeah, the U.S. Attorney's Office basically saying that they did charge nearly 900 people with theft last year. There's some debate about those numbers. The Sentencing Commission shows slightly different numbers. So first of all, there's disagreement on the basic facts of the case. And then, you know, the prosecutor's office over the last year especially has fielded a lot of blame for the rise in crime. The U.S. Attorney's Office is in many ways on the defensive because they want to show that their prosecutors are doing their jobs. And there are a lot of other factors that determine whether these cases go through and in large part whether they think they might actually win them. It's a tricky one. And I think it sort of comes down in some ways to how much we want to prioritize stopping property crime at the cost of potentially locking a lot more people up. And I think that there's legitimate disagreement about that question.
The other place where there were sort of last minute disagreements was on this question of DNA collection, which stirs a lot of privacy concerns and Orwellian stuff. What happened there?
So in the initial version of SecurityC, Councilmember Pinto wanted a provision in there that would have expanded the collection of DNA evidence. So now upon arrest, police can take DNA. Prosecutors and Pinto's office say that a lot of other cities have this practice in place, but other council members really took issue with that and said, you know, DC, unlike many other cities, is majority Black and people of color. And it's those people who are disproportionately affected by policies around crime, and the sort of surveillance privacy issues here are super concerning. And it was Councilmember McDuffie who led an amendment at first successfully to remove that provision. Councilmember Pinto came back with a compromise, basically saying that DNA will now be collected if somebody is charged with a violent crime or sexual assault and a judge finds probable cause. So honestly, from my perspective, it was some legislative chops from her, and that amendment of hers passed.
I know we got to move on, but one sort of last question, which is, for years, we've heard about there's a divide in the council between a progressive bloc and a more centrist bloc. The progressive bloc has taken a lot of crap for the, you know, allegedly being responsible for the rise in crime. What does this vote and the process that got us here tell us about where the council stands and who our council members are?
So I chatted with Chairman Mendelson the other week, and he said to me one of my favorite quotes in a long time, which basically is that all the public pressure from Congress, from residents, from business owners, from the media, from people in, you know, all the noise coming at the city council saying, hey, you're not doing anything to address crime, has made them, quote, ornery, on edge, and difficult, which I thought was pretty funny for a number of reasons. And then he straight up says, this is not the same council than the council we had 4 years ago. So I think that speaks actually to the reality in some ways more than this divide, is that the council itself has shifted slightly. I think the fact that this bill passed with only Councilmember Tran White voting present sort of solidifies that shift.
I love ending a segment on a Mendo quote.
Me too.
Everybody knows that getting that perfect Mother's Day gift is basically impossible, but we promise Mom will love this one. The Capitol Hill Restoration Society House and Garden Tour is back this Mother's Day weekend on May 11th and May 12th. Tour 9 elaborate homes and gardens and 3 historic buildings on Capitol Hill that you can't normally enter. And if you can't make it, check out the Capitol Hill Restoration Society's other events like walking tours and monthly preservation cafes. You can buy tickets for the Mother's Day House and Garden Tour on Eventbrite, and be sure to follow CHRS on Facebook and Instagram at Capitol Hill Restoration DC. Hey DC, one of the reasons hosting this show is so important to me is this statistic from the U.S. Surgeon General. Ready for it? The percentage of Americans who report feeling very attached to their community is only 16%. Now, there's a lot of ways to look at that number, which, by the way, is pre-pandemic data. But here's how I'm thinking about it. CityCast DC is something that we're building to make it easier for you to feel attached to this community. I don't want anyone to feel lonely or bored here in DC. I want you to know how you can help make this city more fun and more livable, and where all the good local stuff is at. And if you think we're doing a good job, I'm asking if you'll become a member of CityCast DC today at membership.citycast.fm. You'll get exclusive perks like ad-free listening, event invites, and members-only guides. But most of all, you'll be part of a project dedicated to making the number of DC residents who feel attached to this community a heck of a lot higher than 16%. See you over at membership.citycast.fm, and thank you.
So the other thing that happened in the council this week that was a subject of like debate that is like weirdly contentious. We've had, you know, for a couple of years now, big debates around should DC basically abolish tipping, that is to say, make restaurants pay everybody the same minimum wage as you get working in a store or a construction site or whatever. And instead of having tips being an expected part of the wage, have them be something else. And then restaurants have had a kind of, well, what do we do to make ourselves whole? And do we raise prices or do we add a service charge or whatever? This issue was bafflingly, to me at least, reopened in the council. What happened and what does it mean for the average diner?
Yeah. So, you know, I think the purpose of the bill was actually, it's a restaurant relief bill. It's really to help businesses, a lot of small independent businesses, get back on their feet after the pandemic. It wasn't necessarily a bill designed to address service fees. But as Councilmember Duffy said, the service fee conversation took on a life of its own. I think because we're seeing so many more service fees these days in D.C., you know, with Initiative 82's passage, tips employees are paid more by their employers. But that also means that, you know, that's an adjustment period. And as you said, restaurants are trying to figure out where does money come from? You know, they can't make it appear out of thin air. They have to find somewhere. And so a lot of them do institute these service fees where the 20% charge or the 15% charge will go to employees' wages. But it's become a hot button topic because I think there's also a lot of the dining public that doesn't like to feel like that option's taken out of their hands. That you might be somebody who would go dine out. You would leave a 20% tip if the service was good, but you don't like being told that you have to leave a 20% tip or that the 20% tip is somehow like built into the cost of the meal that you find, especially that you find out afterwards.
Wait, I mean, I don't mind that. I mean, I hate surprises. Emily, when you go to a restaurant, do you look at the small print on the menu and say that such and such service charge will be appended, or does it piss you off when you see one?
I have to say the place I've noticed it most is in my morning coffee orders. This one place, I'm not going to name it, but this one place I used to go to, all of a sudden my Americano is $5. And seeing that on the screen looks a lot different to me than the price I was paying before. And it has made me not want to go there anymore. So I will say, whether that's rational consumer behavior or not, it is a little jarring.
Yeah, I agree that I think it's one thing when you're at a full service restaurant having a meal where there is service. It's another thing when you're picking up takeout or you're grabbing a cup of coffee or you're having a $20 cocktail and all of a sudden the service charge is there and it makes it a, you know, $25 cocktail, which is already insane. So I think that there is that element of choice. And, you know, one of the things that the council did do was cap service fees at 20%. Some people said it was too high. Some people said there shouldn't be a cap at all. But, you know, I've definitely been to restaurants, especially more fine dining places, where there's a 22% fee.
What, I mean, in theory, a place could append fees for whatever it wanted, a chair fee. Like, you can come, but you got to pay an extra 10% for your chair.
Like an airline.
Or, I mean, like an airline, right? That there's all kinds of ways to, like, dun customers. Is it just a service fee that's eliminated, or are there going to be other creative ways of separating us from our money?
No, and I think there's a misconception that restaurants are kind of out to kind of trick customers or somehow get money out of them that they weren't getting before. I think this is really an adjustment period. They're trying to figure out how to function, how to work, how to serve hospitality. You know, I know a lot of the restaurateurs, like, they really care about treating both their employees and their customers well. I think that it's a difficult time right now when labor costs are going up because they voted against accelerating Initiative 82's timeline. There's going to be another slight bump from $8 to $10 an hour in July for tipped employees. And when you have, you know, 25 employees, that adds up.
I guess the big question is, okay, COVID happened. It was terrible. People stayed home. But I have a hard time getting reservations. Do restaurants need relief? Do they need relief more than pharmacies or grocery stores or anything else?
I mean, as somebody who covers the dining scene and enjoys going out to eat a lot, I would argue, yes, I think a lot of the things that people paid attention to were service fees, which sucks up like a lot of the time in the meeting, and Initiative 82. But the bill also includes some, you know, less sexy, but very important for businesses, provisions like, you know, D.C. has some of the highest liquor liability insurance premiums in the country. Sometimes they are 100 times higher in D.C. than Virginia or Maryland. And the bill clarified some conversation about how can businesses identify a patron who is inebriated, and that goes into lowering these premiums. So those are things that people aren't really talking about as much, but they're very important for businesses. And it's a way to help businesses out and also level the playing field between D.C., Maryland, and Virginia.
So there's this tourist advocacy group called Travelers United. It's the one that has been suing restaurants, including in D.C., for junk fees. They say this bill is unfairly protecting restaurants. Sounds like you don't agree with that.
I don't, especially when restaurants are complying with everything laid out by DC's Attorney General. They're posting the fees on their menus. They're posting the fees on their websites. And suing Clyde's Group or Need Hospitality, now they're going after the group behind Proper 21 Sports Bar, which institutes a 5% fee. I think that that created kind of a safe harbor for restaurants that are falling in line is a good measure.
And a deep tip on top of the service charge.
That's a really tricky, especially when it's a 20%, I usually do not, unless the service has been phenomenal, or sometimes just because of the line of work, know the chef, they'll send out an extra plate. Maybe I'll, you know, leave a little bit on top of that to make up for having been comped something. But for the most part, I don't. The service fees that get me are the ones that are like 6% or like 8.5%. So then I'm having to do all this math. It's a little more confusing when they're saying, here's a lower service fee that's going towards, you know, our employees' insurance. And then I'm like, well, now I need to tip the person directly. I went to a very like hot restaurant right now, and there was a 22%, which will probably change, service fee on the tab. And the server dropped the tab and said, that's not a tip, by the way. And so we had this whole discussion of...
For what?
Yeah. So, and it was 22%, which is high.
The meaning they don't give that to the server? What does that mean? That's not a tip.
So service fees are, by definition, they're not tips. They're properties of the restaurant, and the business can do with them what they want. You know, now there's more guidelines. You have to say the tip, this service fee goes to employees' wages or healthcare, or, but you know, you could technically take a service fee and use it to pay your rent. And so what this restaurant was doing was saying, okay, I think the service fee is supposed to go towards employees' wages, but it's kind of spread out among the pool of employees. And then the tip goes directly to your server who's on that table. And so they had a line saying, do you want to add 1% more, 2% more, 5% more for your server? But by the end of that, you know, you could be tipping 27 or 28% on a meal, which is a lot. And I don't think most people would do that, you know, on an average meal.
It literally changes the taste of Emily's coffee.
Yes, exactly.
It does.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it, all while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
So, yes, on this pod, people have heard me talk a lot about sort of the future of downtown and the shape of downtown and what are we going to do in a situation where we've got all of these sort of unattractive 1960s and 70s and 50s office buildings that people don't seem to want to come into the office in. And there's been a lot of proposals. Can we turn them into housing? Can we turn them into like university outposts? There's the mayor rolled out a big proposal last week. Something that's probably not able to be the economic driver of DC's future, but seems really cool to me, opens today. The Art-O-Matic, it was the 25th anniversary. Art-O-Matic takes over an empty space and stages art shows and events and stuff for 6 weeks, beginning March 8th. But it is happening in a disused office building, 21st and M, this year. And I haven't been to an Art-O-Matic in years, but I really want to go because if you go to their site, you get a sense of like how cool it looks. But also we've all heard about art shows in like warehouses and whatever, but like in one, the most DC of spaces, and two, the most like really troubling for the future in 2024 of spaces. I don't know, I'm going to go. I hope you guys should too.
Yeah, it looks cool. I was reading about they have a recreation of a funeral home viewing room and you can hop in the coffin and see what that was like. That sounds interesting.
It's dark.
That's that too is very downtown in 2024, unfortunately.
Exactly. Exactly. No, but I love the idea, you know, you get the great piece about, you know, on the downside, DC is feeling like it's returning to 90s in terms of crime, but maybe it's returning to 90s in terms of art spaces and kind of cool, funky things to go to. So,
you know, it's funny. So much of like cool art space and like, you know, when DC had a really killer music scene and stuff, a lot of it was predicated on real estate values being very low in a lot of places. You could rent a, you know, house with a practice space in the basement, or you could have a club and no one was going to complain about the loud noise next door because next door was abandoned or something like that. And you don't wish that on any city, but insofar as there's possibly some fringe benefits to the troubles downtown, maybe art is one of them. It is unfortunately probably not a thing that can revive an economy, though.
Yeah, but it is interesting. You see a trend with this, with like, remember Blind Wino when they took over that church?
Yes.
And kind of painted Technicolor, had really cool exhibits. And I was talking with Ian Callender, who runs all the sandlots around DC, and his vision has always been, you take these underutilized or abandoned spaces, set up something cool there temporarily to kind of activate them. Even like, you know, the sandlot Georgetown, it's going to be old gas station. It's going to be redeveloped into probably condos or something like that. But the idea is to, you know, let's bring in go-go music and, you know, chefs and food trucks and make this attractive for a short period of time instead of just having this kind of empty eyesore.
Anyway, that is now March 8th until April 28th, Wednesdays through Sundays, 2100 M Street Northwest. Be there. Anna, Emily, thank you guys for being here.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that is all for today here on CityCast DC. Our senior executive producer is Brianka Tilvey. Our senior producer is Julia Karen. Our newsletter editor is Kayla Cote Stemmerman. Our production assistant is Ash Durbin. And our hosts are Bridget Todd and me, Michael Schaefer from Politico. Music is by Alex Roldan. If you enjoyed the show, why not take over your own disused office building and tell everyone there about it? We'll be back Monday morning with more news from around the city. Bye.